We've got an interesting topic to think about today, which is the title, Why Doesn't Christianity Just Get On and Apologise for All the Harm That It's Done? So I'm sure you've got some views on that, and I look forward to sort of discussing those with you. It was, if you're old enough, you'll remember Elton John singing in the 1970s, Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word. Does anyone remember that? Sorry seems to be... Yeah, I won't sing it, but if we have a volunteer over there, we could do that. But, in fact, if you're up to date, someone's telling me that Blue have done a cover version of that. So if you were too embarrassed to put Elton John on your iPod, you could have Blue, and you could enjoy it that way. But when it comes to saying sorry, actually our politicians recently have not seemed to find that sorry is the hardest word. I don't know if you've noticed that, but there's been a bit of a trend for apologising by politicians, not actually for things that they've done, but for things that other people have done. And there's been a marked trend over recent years by politicians to apologise for historical wrongs. So I don't know if you remember, Tony Blair was an absolute master at this kind of thing, I have to say that. He apologised for the slave trade. You'll know that the slave trade was abolished in the British Empire in 1807, on March 25th, in fact, which was a great day. Tony Blair apologised for the fact that it happened at all, and he felt that it was an important thing to do that on an anniversary of the slave trade. So he stood up and made a public apology for the slave trade and the British participation in it. He also apologised a year later for the Irish potato famine as well, which is another interesting thing to apologise for, which happened in the 1840s. And as I say, he was superbly good at this kind of... it just lent it to all of his wonderful PR skills, you know, the croak of the voice, the glistening eyes, the apology, it was all there. And Gordon Brown did a little bit of the same kind of thing, although he didn't quite have the same panache, I think it's probably fair to say. But he apologised for various things. He apologised for the deportation of children to other Commonwealth countries. That happened probably 60 or 70 years before the apology was made. So this is a kind of trend. I'm sure we can all think of things that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown should have apologised for and haven't, but there are a couple of things that that they did actually apologise for. And more recently, David Cameron made an apology after, you'll remember, the report that came out, Lord Savile's inquiry. Do you remember that? It's a Bloody Sunday. And David Cameron apologised for Bloody Sunday, which is an event that happened, as everybody knows, in Derry or Londonderry in 1972. So again, well before he had anything to apologise for himself. And it's not just a British thing, although in Britain we love to say sorry. We're kind of professionals at that, aren't we? You know, if someone bumps into you in a crowd, you're the one who says sorry. And it's sort of automatic for us. But it's not just British. Bill Clinton also had a great line in apologies as well. And he actually apologised, an important topic, in the 1990s when he was in Africa. He apologised for the genocide in Rwanda on behalf of the whole world. He said, the world owes you an apology. It's quite interesting, isn't it? He wasn't apologising for his own inaction. He wasn't apologising for Washington's inaction. He wasn't even apologising on behalf of Americans. Bill Clinton was apologising on behalf of the whole world, and it was a sort of unreserved apology. Again, it's interesting. I was just checking this out. I couldn't resist doing this. But when you look at actually what politicians might themselves apologise for, I had a look. Bill Clinton did sort of apologise for the Monica Lewinsky affair. Do you remember that? I'm sure we all remember that quite well. And I was looking at the words that he used, and it's not to... I think it's true to say they weren't unreserved. He said, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. And he says it was a personal failure on my part. Which is kind of interesting, isn't it? I know these are kind of sensitive things, but you can apologise in a very expansive way for other people's mistakes. Perhaps we're a little less comfortable apologising so unreservedly for our own. And it's you could look at the whole United Nations, really. Heads of state from just about every country have apologised for some kind of historical wrong. Boris Yeltsin apologised for the Bolshevik Revolution in 1970. Jacques Chirac apologised for the actions of the Vichy government in colluding with the Nazis on the transfer of Jews to Nazi concentration camps. Japanese Prime Minister recently apologised for the whole of the Second World War, which was a good one. An improvement on, I don't know if you remember, there was a big debate about this in the 80s, about Emperor Hirohito and whether he was going to apologise. And the words that he used were, it was an unfortunate period in this century, which is a masterful understatement. Puts me in mind, actually, of the, you remember the Was it the emperor who gave the sort of surrender communication to the Japanese people? And he sort of prefaced it by saying, this is the day after Hiroshima, is it? Or I forget exactly the details, but he said, the war has developed not necessarily to our advantage, which is a magnificent way of using words, I think. Anyway, here we go. So all this is historical. It feels like that. Actually, there is still an agenda out there for lots of apologies. So right now, there's a request that the British apologize to the people of Dresden for bombing that in the Second World War. Nothing's been done with that at the moment, but that's an apology request that's out there. For the Turks massacre of the Armenians in 1917. Again, this is, you know, these are important topics, and people are demanding an apology from the Turkish government. And we can debate whether this is a good or bad thing and whether it's valid or not. We'll do a little bit of that this morning. But our question here is specifically about whether Christians should also be apologizing for things that have happened in the past. And it may feel to you this is a bit of a theoretical question. I don't think it is a theoretical question. I think we live in a climate today, a media climate and a climate with people around us, where Christianity, which is great news, is actually seen as bad news by many people and demanding of an explanation. I mean, you can't get better than the good news of Christianity, can you? This is we're living in God's world. You know, we're not here by chance. You know, God has created this world. He's made us to live in this world. You know, things are messed up. We know why they're messed up. He's told us why they're messed up. It's partly to do with why we're messed up, but he's rescued us from that. You know, in sending his son. You know, these are great things. We can have eternal life if we acknowledge him. This is a wonderful message to be sharing with the world. But actually, instead of hearing good news, they often hear bad news. And part of this is tied up with a general view that religion is bad. So Christianity as a religion is just a bad thing. I mean, Richard Dawkins speaks for more than just a few kind of militant atheists. I think he speaks for quite a lot of people. And you'll remember he had a TV series a while ago. And he said, in his view, religion is the root of all evil. And he's got Christianity very much in mind when he says that. Or if you're a Guardian reader, you'll be familiar with the views of Polly Toynbee, who's their kind of their sort of premier columnist, a very highly regarded columnist. And she thinks that, I was reading, she says that religion is something that we should be afraid of. It's something we should oppose because it corrupts the minds of children and it leads to terrorism and it leads to violence. Now, our minds may leap to kind of militant Islam when she writes like that. Actually, if you read what she says, that's not what she's thinking of primarily. She views all religion in this way. And Christianity is just as much a target in her view as other forms of religion that do turn more naturally to terrorism and violence. And I think, I don't know if you see this as well, but I think there's a climate out there that says, Christianity, you've got a lot of explaining to do. You know, we think you're a malign influence on the world around us. We don't actually think you're good news at all. No, can you please explain what you're about? So I think, you know, it is fair to say that this is a climate out there, and I just want to sort of share, perhaps you might even kick around, I've got some ideas here about the kind of things that, you know, I speak as a Christian here, we're looked at as having sort of perpetrated over the centuries. I can't think, you probably think of things immediately. Maybe we can talk about them. I was going to open it up now, but maybe the best thing to do is just sort of talk about a few things that are out there that are regarded as being evidence of the malign influence of Christianity over the years. So all these things, I've listed down a few of them here, that Christians are sort of regarded as being responsible for, and therefore we should be looking to apologize for. I mean, top of the list comes things like the Crusades. That's always something that people mention, isn't it? So we're going back to, I think the first Crusade was at the end of the 11th century, 1096. So we're looking at a period from there right through to the early 13th century, I think that's right. But people always mention this, don't they? You don't have to talk very much about it. Well, what about the Crusades? Condemnation of Galileo, that's another one that kind of crops up. I don't know if you've had this, but this is sort of cited as being a classic example of how the church is not willing to face up to the scientific realities. You remember in 1633, Galileo was condemned by the church for teaching that the sun was the center of the universe and that the earth revolves around the sun. Or what about the storm of religious protest that greeted Darwin? Again, this is part of the kind of sense, isn't it, that we've got things to apologize for, that we weren't willing to listen to, that Darwin refused to publish The Origin of Species for many years because he was deeply worried about the reaction of a reactionary church and how it would deal with that. And how after it had been published, you know, there were these sort of public battles with people like Bishop Wilberforce, who kind of attacked Darwinism and wasn't willing to even give it any attention. Or in the US, people are very familiar with the Dayton Monkey Trial in 1925, when a teacher, John Scopes, I think he was called, was prosecuted for teaching evolutionary theory to the students. And there was a famous trial, and if you've seen the film Inherit the Wind, which I think is a play as well, you'll see that it's being played out. And there's this idea that Christians are behind this legislation, Christians are behind this prosecution, this poor guy that was simply trying to teach scientific truth. There's this idea that we've got to apologise for that kind of thing. Or I was very interested to read, actually, in the environmental movement. People may have much clearer understanding of this than me. But Christianity is actually often blamed for the despoilation of the environment in which we live. And that's traced back to a view which is widely shared, which is that Christian teaching is that we are the darling of this world that we live in, and that we can have total domination over it. And so there was a guy, this is actually quite often traced back to 1966, a guy called Lynn White, who addressed the American Association for the Advancement of Science on the root of the ecological crisis. And he said this, he said, in his view, the destructive effects of modern technology, the population explosion, the carcinoma of planless urbanism, the new geological deposits of sewage and garbage, are at least partly to be explained as realizing of the Christian dogma of man's transcendence of and rightful mastery over nature. And he concluded that Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt for this situation. And so it's pretty well led to a general consensus that of all the world's religions, it's Christianity which has most to answer for the despoilation of the environment that we now find ourselves living in. I don't know if you knew that, but it's maybe it's making you feel a bit uncomfortable, but that seems to be out there. There's this idea. Or another topic, there's the people cite the damaging exploits of Christian missionaries. You know, advancing alongside traders and really exploiting countries that in the 19th century. I mean, this is encapsulated in quite a well-known saying of a guy called Jomo Kenyatta, who said this: when the white man came, we had the land and they had the Bible. They taught us to pray with our eyes closed, and when we opened them, they had the land and we had the Bible. And there's this idea, and it's quite a well sort of spread idea, that Christian missionaries just destroyed native cultures and imposed an alien and unwelcome religion on unsuspecting people. Or even other ideas, the sexual repression over the years comes from, you know, the Christian teaching about the need to repress the physical body. And so it's found its outlet in years of censoriousness, of prudery, even I was reading of sadomasochistic pleasure and pain, that kind of thing. You know, and you can see this being sort of borne out by people look at, you know, repression of homosexuality through to sort of the Mary Whitehouse prudery. Again, a lot of this is thrown at Christianity. A lot of this is your fault. You're responsible for this kind of thing. Or even final thing, just to sort of kick around now, even things like the persecution of witches. I was reading that is something that's now put firmly and squarely in the Christian responsibility box. Not because it's a question of religious differences and imposing your belief on them, but more a kind of oppression of a patriarchal church over a female sexuality of independent-minded women over in the sort of 16th and 17th century. It was something that, you know, the Christian church couldn't cope with. So there are all these things out there that are regarded as things for which we should apologise as Christians. And you may share some of those views. They may be things that you think we should be apologising for. So that leads us to the question, you know, should we actually be apologising? What does it actually mean to apologise for a historical wrong? Now, historians have two issues with the historical apology. I did a history degree, so I feel I'd like to sort of go into this a little bit. But really, there are two. We have this idea of this historical apology, and there are really two things that are sort of problematic. And I hope, did anyone hear a guy, Jonathan Sumption, speak about this on Radio 4? It was about a month ago. He's quite a remarkable character. He's actually a lawyer, he's a barrister, he's a QC, he's about to become the Supreme Court judge. But in his spare time, he moonlights as a historian, and he's writing a kind of seminal tome on the Hundred Years' War, and he's on volume three of that now. And each of these is about 1,000 pages long, and he just does this over the summer vacation, as well as handling some of the biggest cases that we have. Quite a remarkable character. But he pointed really to two things that are problematic when it goes to actually making an apology for the past. And the first thing is, it's anachronistic. Right? So that's the problem that historians have with it. Because what you're actually doing when you apologise for something that happened a long time ago is you're really judging the past by the standards of the present. In fact, what you're actually doing, and this is something Jonathan Sumption said, I thought he put it very well, what you're doing is you're rebuking the past for not being more like the present. That's what you're doing. So let's say, this is a bit hard work actually. It sounds a bit like a history lecture or something. It's not supposed to be that. But it's saying, I mean, let's say it just doesn't work for historians, right? Because it's clearly anachronistic. You can't go around doing that because you enter this sort of Alice in Wonderland territory where words have no meaning. I mean, let's say that you decided to write an assessment of Napoleon and whether or not he was in line with our equalities agenda that we have today, whether he took seriously equalities principles. I mean, you can imagine, you know, Napoleon and gender diversity in assessment. You know what I mean? It's not actually going to take you very far, is it? Or the Vikings and human rights. You know, it's just... So historians have a bit of a problem with this kind of thing. Actually, the real problem they have with it is that they can't really cope with the idea that there could be any kind of moral consensus, moral code, which is outside of the shifting consensus of society from time to time over the centuries, which is quite an interesting one. So, because if you're really going to judge the past by the standards of the present, what you're really saying you're doing is you're judging them by reference to a moral code which stands outside time altogether. There's something independent which you can point to and you can assess people against. We'll come back to this in a minute, but you would need actually have a revealed set of values in order to come up with a proper assessment of whether rights or wrongs were done in the past. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that in order to have any kind of apology, you have to have a legitimate apologiser and you have to have a legitimate apologisee, if I can say that. You've got to have someone who's actually capable of standing and making an apology to the people, and you've got to have people who are actually in line with the victims and can receive that apology. And obviously the further back in time you go, the more difficult that becomes. It's not impossible, but it's more difficult. Because you might be trying to accept an apology on behalf of ancient victims. And in a way, it's rather artificial. So if you consider Tony Blair's apology for the potato famine, which actually was very well expressed. I had a look at it. I was scoffing about it a bit earlier on, but it was quite well expressed. And in a way, actually, it started a chain of events that actually really helped the Irish peace process. So I really don't want to sort of be dismissive of it. I sound as though I am. But actually, when you consider what he's doing, you know, he did not cause the Irish potato famine, right? So he is standing there as a representative of, I guess, the Prime Minister at the time, which was Robert Peel in the 1840s, and saying, look, I represent him, and therefore I apologise. But he's also apologising on behalf of us, I suspect, as well. That's what he's trying to do. But, you know, accepting that, I suppose, we're descended from 19th century Englishmen, some of us. So I suppose that's true. I guess we speak the same language. We live in the same country. But if Tony Blair's apologising to the Irish for the potato famine, I feel like putting my hand up and saying, I didn't do it. You know, I didn't do it. You know, in what sense are you apologising for me? So there has to be some kind of connection with the person who is sort of making the apology, have the standing to do it, and also for the person who's receiving it. So I don't know if that helps us as Christians kind of work out whether we should be making an apology or not. These two points about whether we've got a sort of, whether we can actually do it, whether there's any continuity. So I've been giving this a bit of thought. Because instinctively, actually, I'm quite dismissive of the whole idea of apologising for things in the past. But, you know, actually, I've come rather reluctantly to think, as Christians, we actually should be thinking about apologising for things that maybe we didn't do ourselves that happened in the past. I actually think we should. You may have a different view from that. We'll talk about that later. But if you consider that point about it being anachronistic, that historians don't like, actually, As Christians, we do say there is a moral code in the Bible which stands outside of the shifting morality of societies from time to time. So there is something to appeal to, so to speak, outside of just changing moral values that we can look at. So I think that's the first point, because clearly if we're Christians, those of us in the room who are Christians, that's what we believe the Bible to be, God's revealed truth about certain standards. Now, happily, my example of that, the equalities of gender, I don't think is something that's an equivalent sort of moral standard, but certainly there are fundamental moral truths that I think we can apply. And as Christians, we feel we should have applied to us. And in terms of the connectivity, again, you know, I was sort of saying that there's a problem here with Tony Blair apologising because the connection that he has with the people who actually perpetrated it is rather artificial. But I think as Christians, there is actually quite a strong connection that we have with our forebears who were Christians as well. And I say that because, I don't know if at Christchurch you still say the Apostles' Creed from time to time, I'm sure you do, but you'll remember in that we say that we say these words: I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Catholic Church, not the Roman Catholic Church, it just means the worldwide church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. I think that's how it goes. But that phrase, the communion of saints, I'm sure you know this, but if you don't, what that actually means is, saints doesn't mean specific holy people. Actually, saints is a word in the Bible that refers to all Christians. I'm sure most people know that here. And what it's talking about is the church in two ways. It's talking about the church across the world, the whole church, worldwide, the Holy Catholic Church. And the communion of saints is also referring to the church down the ages. So we belong to a family, a Christian family, if we're Christians, which is not just people who happen to be Christians today in the world, but actually Christians throughout all the generations. We are part of a big family, and one day we'll be united with those people in heaven, which is a wonderful thing. But they are, so to speak, members of our family. Sometimes it's referred to the church militant and the church triumphant. If you've ever heard those words, that's what they mean. Church militant is the people down below here, us. Doesn't mean that we're fighting in a sort of a holy war or anything like that. It means that we're militantly fighting against sin, if you were wondering. And church triumphant is people who have actually, by God's grace, triumphed over sin, and they don't have to fight it anymore because they're in his presence. And that's, you know, that is Orthodox Christian doctrine, in case you're wondering. I promise you. But anyway, all I'm trying to get at there is actually I think we do have a sense of connection with the Christians who have gone before us. And therefore we should actually be willing to apologise where people point out harm to us. So that question we've got, why is it not time that Christians start apologising for all the harm they've done? Actually, I think it is legitimate to offer an apology, and we should think about whether we actually do that. And I've got news if you were wondering whether we should do that. Actually, Christians have already started apologising quite vigorously for a number of things. And the last Pope, John Paul II, was a serial apologiser. I can't think of a better way to express it. But he apologised, by the last count, I suppose it has to be the last count, 94 times. 94 times he apologised for things that the church had done. In his case, specifically apologising for the Catholic Church, of course. And he has that institutional connection, because I suppose the Catholic Church, the papacy, is one of the oldest institutions, probably a century and a half old, something like that, isn't it? No, what am I talking about? A millennium and a half old, yeah? So I guess he is apologising, when he apologises for things the Catholic Church has done, he's apologising for things that happened that were quite often perpetrated by his predecessors. But he's apologised about the legal processes against Galileo, the slave trade, the church's hierarchy, their role in burnings at the stake and religious wars that followed the Protestant Reformation, the inactivity and silence of many Catholics during the Holocaust, injustices against women, the violation of women's rights and the historical denigration of women. In 1995, he wrote a letter addressed to every woman, which is quite an undertaking. And that was part of it. It was an apology for that, as well as various other things. And I can only think of about, I've only managed to find out a record of 7 of these apologies, but I'm reliably informed he apologised for 94 different things. So there must be 87 other things that he apologised for. And I'm sure some people collected more than one apology, depending on which class you're in for that. And the Church of England has also apologised on a number of occasions, particularly the slave trade, actually, where the Church of England itself had plantations in the West Indies. And I think there was a feeling that as the Church, you know, we, as a member of the Church of England, I say that, you know, we should be apologising for those things. But what about us? I mean, you know, here we are in Christchurch, Virginia Water. Should we be apologising to people who have criticism of the church's record? You know, should you be erecting here a big sign that says, you know, above the church, you know, look, we're sorry for all the bad things that have been done in Christ's name over the years? You know, would that be a good thing to do? Should Stephen Sizer start every service with an apology for anyone who has been offended at any point by things that the church has done? Well, it'd be an interesting idea, wouldn't it? Maybe we should try it once. But I'm not sure that indiscriminate apology is really the way forward, is it? And I think, as Christians, we should be responding to these sort of questions about whether you're willing to apologise on almost a case-by-case basis, if I can say that. And if we are going to say sorry, I think there are certain conditions or filters that we should be applying to work out whether that's the case, whether an apology is genuine. I think the first thing is that, you know, we need to be clear that some of the things that people are demanding apologies for, they need to be genuine in themselves. So actually quite a few of those things I read out earlier on as being, you know, genuine, you might recognise them in the world at large as being aimed at the church, aimed at Christians. They're not really true at all. I mean, that idea that Christianity is responsible primarily or largely for the despoilation of the environment, that's actually a misunderstanding completely of the Christian teaching, in my view. A total misunderstanding, because what they're doing is they're confusing domination with dominion. You see, Christians, if you know, you know, I'm sure many people will know this, you know, we're tasked with stewardship over God's world. You know, we're not tasked with total mastery over it so that we can use it for our own ends. That's not consistent with Christian teaching at all. And in fact, there's a very strong tradition within Christianity of people who had a wonderful record of sort of ecological sensitivity, if I can put it that way, particularly from the Puritans right through the years. And so a lot of this sort of criticism, actually, when you look at the detail of it, it simply isn't justified. And the same thing is true of many of those things I mentioned, particularly the activities of missionaries. You know, the idea that missionaries sort of advanced with a gun in hand, or at least just followed the traders and really exploited the territories that they were sent to, and were imposing a completely unwelcome religion on people who were defenseless in the face of a kind of evangelical evangelistic onslaught. It simply isn't borne out by the facts. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, I might have put you off altogether actually this morning, but if you are interested in it, I'd recommend a book like this. I came across this book. It's called Six Modern Myths About Christianity and Western Civilization. And what it really is talking about is that a lot of these things, they gain current currency. Again, the story about Galileo and the opposition of the church to Galileo. I mean, Galileo, I'm no expert on this, I have to be careful, probably find there are people who really are experts. But, you know, Galileo was as much opposed by the kind of academic establishment of his time than he was by the church. And he probably see, in fact, I was reading a similar kind of thing with Darwin. He was terribly worried about what the academic institutions would have to say about his publication of it, and that was pleasing him much more than any reaction of the church to what he might say. Someone else may have much more understanding of that. But, you know, this is an absolutely terrific book if you're interested in some of the allegations that are thrown against Christianity over the years, saying, look, you Christians have caused a great deal of harm and we need to have an explanation about it. So I might recommend that to you if you're interested. And the second thing is, I think we need to know the purpose of offering an apology to anybody. You know, there has actually to be someone to apologise to. And often there, you know, there just isn't. You know, so when, you know, and often the people who are demanding apologies, I mean, let's say Richard Dawkins is asking for an apology. I'm not sure whether he has actually asked for an apology, but, you know, I do a certain amount of research for talking to you today on this, and I've noticed, you know, there's quite a lot of sort of atheist websites saying, oh, you know, we notice Christians are apologising for this. Why don't they apologise for this, this, and this as well? And so a number of these things are named. But they're not the people who receive the harm. You know, what they're doing is demanding an apology, theoretically on behalf of third parties, who may be, you know, maybe a society, you know, 7 centuries ago. But they're kind of, so to speak, insisting on getting an apology out of the church. Well, that's just not valid, is it? I mean, that's not a credible request, to ask for an apology on behalf of someone else who's not even around to be offended. So I think we need to look at that very carefully and consider who it is that is supposed to be apologised to. I mean, having said that, I think you know, as I say, I think there has to be a purpose for it. And if you can find a sense of connection, I think these apologies can be tremendously powerful. You might be familiar, I mean, it may sound an odd thing to apologise for the Crusades, for example, and there's a lot of debate about whether that was a good thing to do or not, but there was something called the Reconciliation Walk, which happened between 1995 and 1999, I think it was, where people, Christians, decided that they actually felt they had to apologise for this event. But it was done with a particular purpose, which was to be reconciled to the Jews in particular and Islam, and not have this sort of allegation thrown at Christianity. And if we believe in repentance and reconciliation, then I think that has to be a good thing. And I was reading, actually, the words of the apology that were the individuals who participated in this war, which culminated in Jerusalem, as I say, in 1999, that they read out, and they stopped at all sorts of places, from Germany, mosques in Germany, and they went through the Balkans, and they went down to Jerusalem over a four-year period. And they read this out. 900 years ago, our forefathers carried the name of Jesus Christ in battle across the Middle East. Fueled by fear, greed, and hatred, they betrayed the name of Christ by conducting themselves in a manner contrary to his wishes and character. The Crusaders lifted the banner of the cross above your people. By this act, they corrupted its true meaning of reconciliation, forgiveness, and selfless love. On the anniversary of the First Crusade, we also carry the name of Christ. We wish to retrace the footsteps of the Crusaders in apology for their deeds and in demonstration of the true meaning of the cross. We deeply regret the atrocities committed in the name of Christ by our predecessors. We renounce greed, hatred, and fear, and condemn all violence done in the name of Jesus Christ. Where they were motivated by hatred and prejudice, we offer love and brotherhood. Jesus the Messiah came to give life. Forgive us for allowing his name to be associated with death. Please accept again the true meaning of the Messiah's words. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has appointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captive and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. That's powerful, isn't it? That's powerful. And I think that's when an apology as Christians works, and that's when we should be apologising for the deeds of the past. And then my last point on this, and then we'll just throw it open for questions and discussion, is I don't think it's legitimate, really, if we as Christians are being forced to apologise for things that have happened in the past, or we volunteer that, but at the same time, we're not allowed to point to the many good things that have been brought about by Christianity over the centuries. And I sometimes sense that's what happens. You know, people are willing to bag the apology and say, oh, there we go, you know, you're guilty again. You've even admitted it yourself, that Christianity has a terrible, terrible record in this area. But equally, when you try and point to something good that's happened from Christianity, and of course there's a huge spectrum of things, you know, say, well, you say that person's a Christian, but everyone was called a Christian, and that it doesn't point out. They were also a woman, you point to Florence Nightingale or something, and say, well, that person was a woman, and therefore, you know, it was more the fact she was a woman that meant something rather than the fact she was a Christian. And I think, you know, I think it's a wonderfully refreshing thing for us to do, to remind ourselves of the huge benefits that we have in this world, simply because of God's grace from the Christian message, but from that, the community of Christians that have been part of first Western civilization, but now the whole world over the years. And again, if you're interested in, I would point you to a book like this, which is a wonderfully refreshing read. What's Christianity ever done for us? Again, you know, look out for this kind of book. It's absolutely terrific, because it's jam-packed with well-thought-out examples of the many good things that Christianity has brought. So that's all I'd say. Someone's asking for an apology, and you find yourself kind of in the hot seat, because they say Christianity is bad news. I think, you know, we need to apply those things. We need to think about who it is that's asking for an apology. We need to be willing to give an apology, if need be. We need to consider the point of it, that it has to have some point of reconciliation or otherwise. And also we want to be pointing to the unquestionable good that's been brought about by Christianity over the years. Maybe that's a topic for another talk. But why don't I leave it there and throw it up to any discussion or questions. I've bored you into silence, which I might well have done.
Surely the question is not so much about making an apology as coming to the right historical judgment about something. So when the Pope is making all these apologies, what he's doing is recognizing that in the light of modern standards, because you could argue, I think with some justification, that we have, over time, we get a different insight into certain moral issues, like slavery, for example, which is not condemned in the Bible itself, but just taken as backcloth. But over time, it becomes unacceptable. And in that sense, you can argue that mankind is advancing in its moral judgment. And that's really much more important than actually making the apology. But I agree with you that it doesn't cost very much to say sorry. It's more demanding when you have to apologize for what you personally have done than when somebody that you don't know has done. So I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I think the political advantage of making a prominent figure making an apology is quite considerable. So whatever the rights and wrongs of apologizing, or whether it makes any sense, whether it's anachronistic or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but as far as we're concerned, I think we just ought to be prepared to admit that bad things were done, good things were done, and that we're open-minded.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I mean, it's very interesting, recently, the Queen, when she kind of apologized, she used words when she visited Ireland recently that were tremendously powerful. I mean, I was in Ireland shortly after, tremendously powerful and well-received, you know, and I mean, the slave trade is a very interesting one because, of course, it was Christians who actually were the prime mover, as many know, of course, in the abolition of the slave trade, William Wilberforce and so on. But it's interesting that, as well as, so it's a question of having a balanced view, absolutely.
Phil, the teaching of the Bible that springs to my mind on it, I can't think of anything about apologising, but in Matthew 18:15, is that if you have a disagreement, you go in private to reconcile. It seems to be a very immediate thing. It doesn't talk about the historical impact, and it's down to me, what's in my heart, that I have to go in private to reconcile one-on-one with a brother.
Yeah. Well, and, of course, that's where you're the person... Yeah, exactly. I mean, that does link in with the whole idea of responsibility. If you've done... You know, it's important to be reconciled to somebody. If you haven't actually done anything that means that there's a rift in the first place, it makes it more difficult to know how you're supposed to go about that reconciliation. But, of course... Where things are in the present day, you know, what we haven't talked about are things that have happened sort of in the present day that you know, we should be apologising for. I mean, clearly, there's no question whatsoever that Christians, you know, where a Christian institution has committed a harm to somebody, I just think it's awful cases of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and other places. Of course, that should be. There's no question about that need for an apology in that environment and reconciliation. But good point. Thanks, Dave.
Bringing the word apology to us as a group of men, do you agree that the most difficult thing for us to do is to apologise to our parents, our wives and our children?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's where I'm sort of trying to come in, because you know, this is the most important thing for us is to say sorry. You know, forgiveness is the, you know, forgiveness is the whole theme of the Christian message, isn't it? That God has extended forgiveness to us, and we need to ask forgiveness of others. And I couldn't agree more with that statement. That is, so what we're talking about is institutional apologies for things that we haven't done. I think that's where the difficulty arises. In what sense should we be saying sorry for things that other people did? To what extent do we have a connection with those people that allows us to say sorry to try and move things forward? And it's much more difficult to work through, isn't it, than it is to kind of work out whether you yourself have done something wrong.
Although this morning's topic is very much historical apology, I think we must also recognise that a prime example of where modern society apology has really worked is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa.
Yeah.
When Mandela came into power, a lot of people felt that this would lead to a bloodbath. And the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, led by that wonderful person, Desmond Tutu, I think had an awful lot to change people, oppressed people's views. Sadly, the present government has not picked up the ball and really run with it on it, but that's another topic totally.
Yeah.
But the church that I worship in Cape Town was primarily a coloured church, and our congregation is still mainly coloured people. But they lost all their homes there, but now they're being given back the land. Luckily, it hasn't been built on, and they're going to be able to build again, and that's made a very big impression.
But that's a great example of when the apology actually does move things forward, because, as I was saying, you need to have an apologiser and you need to have an apologisee, don't you? You have to have someone who can stand and say an apology, and certainly F.W. de Klerk did apologise, didn't he? Used a form of words which was definitely an apology for the Nationalist Party, that's what it calls it, over the 40-year period of apartheid. And I think, but you've got someone who's able to give a genuine apology on behalf of people, and you've got people who they themselves have experienced the harm over a long period. That helps you move on, I think, in a way. It's much more difficult to apologise for things that have happened, you know, 3-4 centuries ago.
And 99% of the National Party would see themselves as devout Christians.
Exactly. So, but as Christians, you know, I mean, those of us who are Christians in this room, we know we mess up all the time. I mean, that is just part of being, you know, and acknowledging that, being prepared to say sorry. I think maybe this is the point that was being made earlier on, is a fundamental part of it. So, yeah, you know, we shouldn't be afraid. In fact, even if people bag that and say, well, that's a problem for Christians, you know, we should be willing to offer apologies, because that's part of what we are as Christians. You know, repentance is a command and a gift, I think, and we need to do that, offer that. Any other thoughts or questions?
Here we go. Are you aware of any examples in the Bible of people repenting and saying sorry for other people's sins? I wonder if with the Israelites in the Old Testament, whether there are examples of that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, well, I suppose that's true, isn't it? I mean, that is really what the priests are doing when they're offering sacrifices on behalf of all the people, aren't they? And so I think that there isn't a... You know, when you consider events like the Golden Calf or something like that, you know, there is an apology that's demanded of everybody. I mean, it may well have been that there were people in that community that didn't bow down didn't worship the Golden Calf. Just trying to think of an example here. But the apology is on behalf of everybody that's offered by the priests. You know, through the sacrificial system, asking God for forgiveness. So I think that is part of, and that is what Jesus Christ has done for us. In fact, he's now mediating for us as well, isn't he? So I suppose asking for forgiveness on behalf of the people.